I'm Blair Palmer, and welcome to the Punks in Suits podcast, bringing the leadership thinking, beliefs, philosophies, and practices behind punky, startup-y, next-stage businesses to you, even if your company's not quite there yet. Hello, and welcome to episode 18 of the Punks in Suits podcast. Thank you so much for joining me today. This week's episode is an interview with Yehudi Meshaninov. He's a team coach and organizational design consultant. He will explain more about it when we get into the interview. But sometimes you have a conversation that challenges you to see the world differently and ask different kinds of questions. And that's really what I got from my conversation with Yehudi. Asking questions like this.
Well, if fragile is handle with care, what's the opposite of fragile? The opposite of fragile would be drop on intentionally, right? What are things that grow, that flourish through stress?
So without further ado, let's get into the interview. I'm very excited to welcome today's guest, Yehudi Meshaninov. He's a team coach and an organizational design consultant. He's based in Brooklyn, New York, and grew up not very far from there. That's right, isn't it?
Yep, in the suburbs.
Yeah, lovely. So there are lots of things I want to talk to you about, because you contacted me after listening to the podcast and you felt that the work you were doing in New York was very much aligned with the approach that I take over here in Europe. And we had a really good conversation about that. And I'm just really would love you to share what beliefs or philosophy drive your work and maybe explain a little bit about what you do.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'll start with the what and then get to the why. So what I do at the moment is working as a team coach. So actually working with specific teams to help them move forward, tackling whatever challenges or opportunities they're working on at the moment. And what I love about team coaching is it's getting in the trenches and it's working with people through their actual work, rather than doing a training or workshop and then they go back home and have to figure out how to apply it to their context. And I also work as an organizational design consultant with a firm called The Ready, based out of New York. And what we do is similar to team coaching, but just on a larger scale, working with usually large corporate clients, helping them think through how they need to work differently and what that looks like and how they could actually change the fundamental way that they're structured in order to work in more adaptive, more flexible ways. And I think a lot of the things that drive the work that we do is an understanding that the world has changed. And that people need to work in new ways, not only because the marketplace is demanding it, because we need to work faster, we need to be more adaptive, there's so much complexity out there, we no longer could predict and plan and kind of figure everything out and then just go and implement. We need to be continuously learning. But also because I think people want more out of work than perhaps they used to. And, you know, people now want to be collaboratively engaged, they want to be involved, they want to have ownership, they want to be engaged in something that's meaningful and purposeful to them. And a lot of ideas that I think have been around for a long time, theory X and theory Y, for example, right? Do you manage people as if they're up to no good and as soon as you turn the other way, they're going to get into trouble? Or do you really believe that people are inherently looking to be creative and looking to be engaged and looking to do something purposeful? Those ideas have been around for a long time, but I think for the first time, the market conditions are such that companies are realizing that, hey, this is actually something that we need as well. And so part of what I'm really excited about is both in the team coaching work and in the org design work, is a chance to kind of create the environment for people where they can do their best work, where they can work with each other, where they can challenge each other's assumptions, where they can learn and grow as people and as human beings. And I think what's amazing is today that's not only a personal development need or a spiritual need, that's also a practical business need as well.
This is one of the reasons that we had such a good chat when you contacted me, because this idea of people being able to do their best work is so important to me as well. And what I see in organizations is that it's almost impossible for people to do their best work. So they're desperate to do so. I mean, very few people turn up at work wanting to do a bad job, but the system gets in the way of them actually being able to do that and kind of kills their spirit to a certain extent, their belief that they even could do a good job. Is this something that that you've seen in the organizations that you work with, or are you more working with companies that get that this is more important, that have found ways to remove those barriers?
So, you know, I think there's a real range. Some of the people that I've worked with are really excited about these new ideas. They watch the TED Talks, they listen to the books, you know, they ask, what is your why? And they're just trying to figure out, how do you actually do it? So they're very fired up about these ideas. They want to be purposeful, and they just don't know the how. I think for other companies, it's a little different. They just realize things have to change. They realize the old ways aren't working. They're not quite sure where it leads, but they're brave enough to know that they have to take a step forward. So I think, you know, depending on where the client is, try to meet them where it's at. But I think even for those who are very inspired and fired up about these ideas, if you don't have actual tools or ways of doing it, it falls apart very quickly. And one of the activities I love to do when I do leadership development programs, which I do a little bit of here and there, is have a bunch of leaders in the room and give them sticky notes and ask them, you know, what are things that leaders do that create disengagement? And within 15 minutes, we generate an amazing list of 100 or so actions. And whether I've done this in college classrooms, I've done this with experienced leaders, and you get the same things, right? Micromanagement, losing one's temper, all of that stuff. And then I turn around and say, so if we know all of this, why do we do them? And so I think the disconnect between knowing and doing is a big part of the work here. And I think for the most part, people know what's wrong with organizations, and people know that they want it to be different. They're just not sure how to translate that into action. And then, and in the moment, catching themselves, right? If you're the manager that knows that micromanagement leads to disengagement, but when you're on a deadline and it seems not to be working and you're in this command and control model, you just can't help yourself.
I mean, this is a massive question I'm about to ask you, but if people know what to do, what makes the difference between them simply knowing and actually applying that knowledge, really holding themselves to a different standard?
That's such a great question. So I think the way I think about it, there are two parts. One is the context, the actual structures that they're embedded in. Because I think, you know, if you're swimming upstream, it's really difficult to get any traction. And you alluded to this earlier, but our organizations weren't designed for the kind of work that we want people to be doing. And they weren't designed for the kind of leadership we're looking for today. And so I think one thing is to really start changing the context and the environmental structures and influences that the team is embedded in. So to just use a very simple example, if you're really pushing hard for team and you're giving lots of speeches about team and trying really hard to do teaming, and you might have even brought in a team coach, but if your compensation system is all designed around individual reward, you may be incentivizing competition among your team rather than collective effort. And so regardless of how hard you're pushing, if there are certain kind of basic fundamental structures that aren't aligned, I think it's going to be very difficult. So I think the first thing is really taking a step back and looking at what are those structures in the organization, whether it's compensation, whether it's the way power and authority are distributed, the way space is used, all of those things. When I worked with educational reform, we used to talk about the hidden curriculum. And the hidden curriculum were all the things that we were teaching students without ever meaning to teach them. So put kids in a class where everyone's doing the same thing. We kind of teach them that you should all be the same. You know, we divide subjects up by, you know, math and science and English, we're implicitly teaching them that these subjects are disconnected from one another. We group kids by age, you know, rather than by interest or ability level. So we're implicitly teaching all sorts of stuff. The teacher's in the front, the kids are in the back. Mm-hmm. And so one of the questions that, you know, the educational reform theorists would ask is, could we bring critical reflection to unearth what is the hidden curriculum? And I think that's very important for organizations as well.
Yeah, I mean, this is something I wanted to talk to you about anyway, because you are highly educated. You studied at rabbinical school. You have an MA in clinical psychology. You're working on your doctorate at the moment. And yet you're quite cynical in some ways about the way that schools are designed, and just told us right there, you know, some of the reasons why. I'm increasingly concerned about this too. You know, I have a young daughter. I can see the conformity that is being imposed by the school system, even though it's a lovely school with lots of freedom, but still this hidden curriculum is there. We don't seem to be educating kids and young people for the
the world that they're going to inhabit, but for a world and for a set of values that's passed. What's your take on this? What is the problem? And are you starting to see educators rethinking this stuff?
My first job, I actually worked for almost 5 years at an educational reform organization called the New American Initiative. We had a network of public and charter schools in New York City that we were supporting. And that was exactly the question that we were asking. I think in New York at the time, the city was spending around $20,000 per student per year with 1.1 million students. So I think it was a $38 billion budget each year. All that money and so many good people, you know, really well-meaning, hardworking people. And yet the results were not good at all. Kids weren't graduating high school. College readiness rate, I think from the ones who did graduate, was somewhere like 25 or 30%. And started looking at, you know, what is going on here. What I think is fascinating, at least to me, and I'm a bit of a theory nerd, but was looking into the history and seeing that some of the structural challenges that schools face are actually very similar to the structural challenges that we're talking about just now that organizations are facing. And I think one way to think about it is often we say schools are broken, schools aren't working. You know, what are we going to do? Schools aren't teaching the kind of creativity and independent thinking and critical analysis that we want students to have. But the truth is schools are not broken. They're doing exactly what they were designed to do. They just were not designed to produce the kind of results we now want from our students. And if you look at the history of public education, especially in the United States, but I believe that schools in England are similar, is that the first government to actually have statewide sponsored public education that was both sponsored by the state but also compulsory, also mandatory, was the Prussian government. And King Frederick the Great of Prussia was trying to consolidate all these little small city states into a unified Greater Prussia. And he quickly realized that education could be one way to achieve that. And so he took control of the educational system away from the local municipalities and the churches, and a lot of kids weren't going to school, and created an amazingly modern educational system. And I actually have a book somewhere on my shelf where it goes through, by Thomas Alexander, I think it was written in 1918 or something like that, and it goes through the Prussian educational system. But a lot of what we think of as school today, so you have a superintendent in charge of a bunch of principals, you have kids grouped by age, they move, you know, every 45 minutes or so to another subject, you have a curriculum that's planned at the top, all of that kind of stuff was developed in Prussia. And King Frederick says, and we have letters of his, where he says he wants to teach them just enough to be useful, and he wants to make sure that they become a culture to this new Prussian society, but he doesn't want them to think too much. And so schools, not to be dramatic, but essentially schools were designed for uniformity. Schools were designed to inculcate, you know, following rules and following authority, and to embed a certain kind of patriotic narrative. That was what the public system of education was designed to do. And then what happened, it got brought over to the United States and at the beginning of the Industrial Age by well-meaning Horace Mann, who was the first commissioner of education in Massachusetts. He was the one who toured the world and came to Prussia, and he said, wow, they're churning kids out like factories. There's something very impressive about the scalability of this model. So he brought it back to the United States, very well-meaning, thinking that all these poor immigrant kids will at least get an education without, I think, recognizing the hidden curriculum cost that we were talking about earlier. And so then you had the Industrial Age, and all the industrialists said, well, we need to really be preparing kids to work in factories. And the Prussian model was a perfect fit for that. So they just took this state-sponsored educational system and said, we don't need kids to think independently. We don't need people to be creative. We're going to have a bell curve. We're going to use school to sort people. The top 10% we're going to track through academically rigorous programs. They're going to go to Ivy Leagues. They're going to learn how to think. They're going to be the managers. The middle 80% or so, we just need to teach them to work hard, follow instructions, keep their head down, do what they're told, be like everyone else. They'll work in the factory, so we'll have a bell system. Get them used to switching when the bell rings. Oh, great, that's good for factory work. And then the bottom 10%, probably too much effort. They'll just end up as criminals. They'll probably go to jail, and we're not going to bother with them. And that's at the heart of the public educational system, which has then spread across the world. And so I think it's done a lot of good. I think it's brought a lot of education and access to people who didn't have it. But I think fundamentally it was not designed for the kind of results that we want today, which the modern business community is demanding, right? Independent critical thinking. It's a system designed for uniformity. Collaboration. It's a system where you mostly sit alone at your desk, do your own work. Critical thinking. It's a system where you're designed to receive information passively rather than question it. And so I think there are heroic educators that kind of push against the system, but fundamentally they're in a system that is pushing kind of one way. And so the questions that we were asking when I was working at this organization was, could we actually change the system itself so we don't have to fight up, you know, to get upstream all the time? And there are some people doing great work. I know Ken Robinson actually gave a TED talk on this subject, and I believe he's based in England, and there are others. But it's definitely not enough, you know, too little, too late kind of thing. And I think a lot more work is needed. But if I think about the organizational context, it's very much the same thing. Businesses, large corporations, were designed for an industrial age. Kind of command and control hierarchical system works very well for those kinds of needs, where the majority of the workers' job was not to be thinking, was not to be collaborating, was not to be problem solving. Their job was to be implementing. And the problem solvers and the thinkers were the managers, and that was kind of pushed up. And then I think now in the 21st century, things have gotten so complex that if you wait, you know, if you wait for the information to trickle up and then you let the managers decide and then you feed that back down to the implementers, so much has happened in between that that's no longer a viable model. We need every member of the organization to be engaged. We need everyone to be thinking of new ways, new ideas, improving the products, talking to customers, owning service, all of that. And yet we're in the old model that was designed for a different purpose.
Yeah. And of course, the two things reinforce each other. So, you know, teachers operate in an industrial age system and came out of an industrial age education. So then they operate their schools in this way. And the kids that come out, I mean, this is all generalizations, of course, but the kids that come out are trained to think and behave in these ways, with myths such as, you know, if I haven't decided by the time I'm 18 what I want to do with my life, I'm doomed. Whereas in actual fact, I've already had three, in a way, distinct careers, and probably will have at least one more. You know, the idea that you have to decide at 18 and that you channel everything towards this very focused, narrow career ambition doesn't make any sense when most of the jobs that will exist in 15 years' time don't exist today. So I really see that the system is flawed. And at the same time, I see, as you say, there's not very much being done about it outside of little pockets. There are some very interesting schools being set up. There are some teachers doing extraordinary things. And teachers, like people in the organization, are fighting the system, even those that see that they want it to be something different. So you're from the millennial generation.
Yes.
And I wonder if this is part of why you see things the way you do. I mean, I don't really like to categorize people, and it's uncomfortable to label you in this way. But do you think that when you and your contemporaries were born, compared with, say, when I was born back in the 70s, has in some way informed what you now see as a flawed system and what you think the schools and the workplaces of the future need to look like?
It's hard for me to know because I've never been anything but a millennial.
I know, and you know, the funny thing is sometimes I'm asked whether teams behave differently when there's a woman in the room. And I say, I have no idea because I am a woman. I've only ever been in rooms where there is a woman in the room. So I'm afraid I can't tell you. And it's a similar situation to the one you're in with this question.
Yeah, but I can say that there's a lot of research on millennials. They're the largest segment now, at least in the American workforce, and it's only going to continue to grow. And so a lot of people are very curious about this whole millennial question. And I think some of it is a little dramatized. You know, I think millennials are people, and a lot of what millennials want and what makes for a good millennial workspace is what makes for good human workspace. But I do think there's something there around, you know, millennials continuously are polled to saying that for them, the number one thing that they're looking for at their work is purpose and meaningful engagement over salary. And so they'll take a job that's paying a little bit less, but if they feel it's, they're more meaningfully engaged and more purposefully engaged. And I think you're starting to see that a lot. You know, I think it's a combination of several factors, and we could play sociologists and try to understand it. But I think millennials are demanding a higher level of purpose. I think they're demanding a higher level of engagement. They want to be more involved. They want more ownership. They want more flexibility. I think they're demanding a lot more feedback. You know, they're willing to work hard, but they're wanting to find out how they're doing and to move quickly. If there's something wrong, let's fix it. If there's something right, how could I take the next step? So there's some themes that are coming up consistently in the research that I think are pushing organizations forward. But I also think that it's a good fit for the current business needs, because businesses are needing people to kind of be entrepreneurial or intrapreneurial, right, within the organization. And a lot of millennial values, I think, lend themselves well to that.
Do you think it matters what millennials want? I mean, I've certainly got the impression from older leaders in organizations that I work in that, you know, we place too much emphasis on trying to create organizations that feel more like families so that millennials will be comfortable there. Does it matter what the younger workforce want?
If someone's a business owner and they say, you know, all my workers want to bring skateboards and they want to, you know, squirt each other with water guns and this is what they want, should I do it? You know, I think there's definitely a question of where's the line. But I think a lot of what millennials are asking for is just good practice. So, you know, just thinking of Amy Edmondson's work on psychological safety, right? Her research wasn't just focused on millennials. We all do better when there's psychological safety, where we're able to be given real honest feedback because we know at the same time that, you know, it's not a reflection of who we are as a person and that we're valued in the company. And so we can let our guard down and be real with each other. And so I think some of what the millennials are asking for, or what they're kind of highlighting as a business need, is stuff that we know makes for good work. We know that when people are in a team where they're given ownership, involvement leads to commitment, right? So we know that that's a great way to get people to really take ownership and to start thinking of ideas on their own. We know that when you, I was just talking about this actually on a call with a client earlier today, where we were setting up all these projects, and you know, he said, we need a project manager to manage all these projects. And my colleague, who's also a millennial, said, how could we help the project teams take ownership over their projects? So we don't need a project manager. You know, we've built these elaborate bureaucracies where we have people managing people who are managing the people, instead of figuring out ways to let people take ownership over their own work. And I think part of the whole millennial story has been this whole startup culture that has evolved in the tech world, but then has since spread. And a big part of what's appealing, I think, to a lot of people about startup culture is that you're a group of people, you own the work, you make it happen. You don't have managers who are managing your schedule or project managers who are trying to follow up on the updates. And so, you know, I think beanbags and water guns aside, I think most of what actually makes a difference, what actually moves the needle, is not the gimmicks. It's the kinds of stuff that builds real trust, that allows people to be rigorous in their thinking, to really challenge assumptions, give each other real feedback, to take risks together, and then to learn quickly from them, to be okay with failure. And I think that's the kind of stuff that we've been talking about.
Yeah, and I can't see why a Gen X or a baby boomer would think that there was a problem with that, particularly when we see what we really need. I mean, I also speak frequently CEOs and senior guys about what they need from their people, and they need their people to bring their best to work. They need them to take responsibility. They need them to innovate, to have ideas, to fix, to resolve tensions in the organization. It isn't just the young ones.
It kind of loops back to that first question that you asked about supporting this kind of change. And I started saying, I think the first thing is, you know, changing the structures so that you're not working against the system. But I think the second piece that's equally, if not even more important, is changing the mindset. And that's where I think, even though executives are saying this is what they want, and as you said, you know, everyone wants the workers to be more engaged and to be more collaborative and to be problem solving, I think there's a real recognition of it takes a different mindset and we have to give certain things up. And I think that's part of why it's so difficult, not necessarily only for you know, managers who are older, but for anyone in leadership position, because we have a deep need for security, stability, safety, clarity. And those are things which may no longer be attainable, but that's really hard to let go of. And so, you know, I think it sounds good to say we're going to empower everyone, but the flip side of that is you're going to have less control. The flip side of that is you're going to have to be more of a servant leader than a kind of point the finger, lead the way kind of leader. You know, the flip side of that is that you may not have a clear sense of where the organization will be in a year or two, not because it wouldn't be nice, but because the market doesn't support it. You know, the flip side of that is that you may have to be willing each day to come to a meeting and say, this is what I'm thinking, what are you thinking, and let your assumptions be challenged. You know, you may realize that who you are as a person is actually getting in the way of the work. And so if you're someone who likes everything ordered and organized and dot your I's and cross your T's, you may find out that that's limiting the way you're thinking about something, and you may get pushback from a team member and have to grow as a person. And on the flip side, if you're a big picture person who's all excited to talk about the forest and forgets the details, you may get that kind of feedback. You know, you may learn you're not a good listener as you thought you were. And so all the messy stuff of what it means to work in a team that's navigating an uncertain world, as opposed to working in a certain world. In a certain world, you could divide up the work. Each person gets a piece. You go off. You finish your piece. You come back together. You put it together. Everyone is happy. Nobody really has to go out of their comfort zone. And in a messy, kind of uncertain world, we have to each try something, come back together, share what we're learning, see if things have changed, give each other feedback. And I think the kind of mindset change, the self-growth, the real work that has to happen on individuals and on teams to support that is part of why we see resistance, because that's hard. I mean, I teach this stuff and I struggle with being direct and honest in my communication and asserting my assumptions and having them be challenged and letting go of something. You know, you're working on something, get all excited about it, and then letting go and realizing that's actually not where it needs to go, and always be iterating. It's what our workplace is demanding, but I think it takes a different way of being, not just a different way of thinking.
So it's interesting that even you find it hard. And I'm thinking about whether companies, even with the best will in the world, can get this wrong. You know, if the workplace becomes more human and allows for or encourages more honesty, more authenticity, more individuality, can that backfire?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think organizations are systems, right? So anytime you change something, it has an impact across the whole system. And sometimes that impact is unintentioned. And I think something that I see, actually, I used to do a lot of team coaching with startups and with younger companies. And often there would be a team leader who was a big believer in this stuff. They watched the TED Talks, you know, they listened to the podcast, so they're really trying. And so they wouldn't tell anyone what to do. They would sit in a room and say, let's all figure this out together. And yet we know that's an absolute disaster, right? Consensus-driven decision-making never works. People get frustrated. Things aren't clear. People leave meetings with different assumptions or expectations about what's going to happen. Then it doesn't happen. Then they get into fights with each other. And so, you know, I think that's a great example of someone who, in their really well-intentioned desire not to be top-down, not to tell people what to do, left things ambiguous and unclear, which ended up fermenting more conflict. And one of the things that I remember from my organizational psych studies that I kept using with these teams was that 90% of team conflict comes from a lack of clarity around, we call it grumpy, goals, roles, processes, and then the interpersonal pieces last. And if you clarify the goals, and if you clarify the roles, and if you clarify the processes, how are we giving feedback, how are we sharing information, all of that kind of stuff, 90% of the team conflict goes away. And so, you know, I think sometimes well-intentioned but undisciplined or uninformed change leads to more pain, or at least in the short term. And so helping them realize that it's really important to have clarity. Now, there are two ways to get there. One way is in a top-down way, where it's clear because you told everyone what to do. Another way is collaboratively. You could do an activity, you could do an exercise, you could put up a list of all the tasks, you could use sticky notes, you could break it out. But by the end of that activity, whether it's been collectively generated or individually generated, there has to be clarity wherever possible. And where not possible, it has to be tagged as something that is not clear at this moment, and this is what it will take to get it clear, or we'll come back to it, etc. So I think that that is definitely a dynamic I've seen a lot of. I think another dynamic that I've read a little bit about are organizations that take one principle and really try to implement it without understanding how it fits into the rest of the system. So, you know, just to use something that's been in the news recently in the States, Bridgewater is, I think, one of the most successful, if not the most successful, hedge fund company. And Ray Dalio, who founded Bridgewater, is a genius and really passionate about transparency. And so he's created a culture in which they record every meeting. They have a system where people could upload little feedback for each other. And they really drive, be honest, be direct, be ruthless with your, you know, your comments, don't hold back. And I have friends who've worked at Bridgewater and have substantiated this. And then there was a New York Times article that came out recently talking about all the kind of the shadow of that culture and all the backstabbing that has been going on and the tensions that have been raised. And my own two cents about it, having read it about it and talked to some people who work there, is that they emphasize the transparency without the safety piece. And so I think, you know, for teams or companies to work well, transparency is amazing, really important, but there also has to be the safety and the trust. And so, you know, I think that's another example. And at the end of the day, they're still very successful, and I think they're still trying to figure it out. So we'll see where the final results will be. And I think there's an argument to be made that sometimes it's better to try something and fail than not to try anything at all. But I think there's definitely lessons to be learned about trying to implement some of these changes without really understanding why you're doing this, where is it coming from, what might the impact be, and do we have a process to support this change so that it's actually ingested and processed rather than just kind of, okay, now we're everything is transparent, let's see what happens.
One of the big shifts in mindset that needs to happen around all of this is that organizations or the people within organizations need to move to a state of mind that says we're always looking to fix the system. So the classic model, not only is it hierarchical and command and control and about compliance, but it's also about stability. So there may be change, but there will be change on occasion. It will probably be a big change all at once. Everything's disrupted and then things will settle down. And people hate it. I mean, I've been involved in enough change programs to know that that doesn't work. People hate it. Everything is thrown up in the air. Everything lands in a different place, but there are some of the problems haven't been resolved. Some of the problems have, but new tensions are now in the system. So really those programs don't seem to make anything better. But what you're talking about and what I'm starting to see is organizations that take their governance and their resolving of tensions very seriously and build that into the way that they work. So an old-fashioned leader might think, well, we spend a lot of time talking about things, you know, we spend a lot of time navel gazing, we spend too much time thinking about how we're going to do stuff and not getting on and doing it. But in these new kinds of organizations, they recognize that if they're not constantly looking at it and tweaking it and asking what's working and what's not, then they will start to hardwire stuff into the system that becomes increasingly stagnant and increasingly problematic.
Absolutely. I love that. I love that thought of constantly learning. You know, I mentioned my work with the Ready earlier, and essentially what we're doing with a lot of these large corporate companies that have been around for a long time is trying to get them into a place where they're continuously iterating, continuously learning as a system. And what does that look like? And there's a fabulous book called Anti-Fragile by Nassim Taleb, where he talks about this idea. He says, well, if fragile is handled with care, what's the opposite of fragile? The opposite of fragile would be drop on purpose, intentionally, right? What are things that grow, that flourish through stress? And if you think about how we learn and grow, we grow through stress. If there's too much stress, we break. But if there's just enough stress, our muscles grow. That's how we learn how to walk. That's how we learn anything in life. And a child that was put in a room where there would be no stress would atrophy. And so he talks about how do you build systems that are anti-fragile, that they grow through stress. And so rather than waiting, keeping things stagnant, and then there's this huge stress comes along that's too big to fail, and then you all come apart, could you be continually iterating, continually learning, continually being exposed to the stresses of the marketplace and the internal stresses, and then adjusting as you go along? And I love that image, because if you think of biological systems, whether it's the body or even the forest, or think about really large biological systems, there's no command and control. There's no one orchestrating a forest. No one says a tree should grow here, an animal should hunt there. And yet a forest is an ecosystem that's kind of self-sustaining, because there are certain basic rules of the game. And then each organism plays its own role in this emergent system. And forests are incredibly rich. And I think there's some examples of man-made systems. I know there's some research on cities, for example, that as cities grow, they become more efficient. Which is interesting, because when you think of companies, as companies grow, they become less efficient and more bureaucratic. But cities, again, aren't centrally organized. No one tells you open a falafel store here, at least not in the Western world. And yet, this kind of self-organizing emergent iterative process leads to more successful cities. So helping figure out how to get companies more to that place where they have decentralized power, so that people could be continually trying things, learning things, and then as soon as something is successful, that information gets shared throughout the rest of the system, and then other people play with it and build on it. That's the kind of work that we're doing. I think we're still in the initial stages. A lot of what we're doing is new and exciting, and we're figuring out with our clients together. We definitely don't have the answer, but it's moving towards the direction of what you were saying, a real learning organization that's continually iterating rather than a company that thinks we know what it is and we know how it's done, because that's only going to be true for a very small amount of time before it's no longer true.
In the past, when I've talked about organizational design, I've been quite critical, because I've said it's a distraction. I've said it in this conversation today. It's a distraction. It's about shuffling people around, not really changing anything. Just create a new set of problems. And yet you're in the org design business. So can you put me right on this? Can you explain to me what org design should be about when it's done well?
Absolutely. I think I love this question, because I'm on the same page as you. And I think it's a question of language, right? I believe it was Drucker who said that, you know, culture eats structure for breakfast. And I've always believed that. And one of my mentors, Barry Gents, always used to say that for years, whenever there was a problem, they would just do a reorg. And then, you know, 6 months later, when the dust settles, the problem is still there, but people feel good that they've done something. And so initially I was also quite skeptical about, is org design, you know, just a fancy way to do a reorg and call it something else. But I think the kind of work that we're doing, and the kind of work that, you know, other people who are in this space that are doing good work are doing, I think is very different than that. It's not about where people are on the org chart. It's really about looking at that hidden curriculum that we were talking about earlier. It's exploring what are the values and the assumptions of the organization. So when we use structure, we don't even mean the org chart. That's a very external manifestation of structure. When we use structure, we mean, what are all the unwritten rules? What are all the ways of doing things that you don't even think about, but that kind of underlie the way the organization runs? And actually, on our website at theready.com, we have our OS canvas. And our OS canvas is our organizational structures canvas. And the way we think about it is, you have an operating system, right? Your OS system. And if you think about your computer, for example, regardless of the software that you get, you have a certain operating system that you don't even pay attention to, but that really informs everything that happens in your computer. So if you're using a Mac, or if you're using a, you know, Microsoft product, the operating system is kind of behind the scenes and yet informing everything. And so we think about, what is the operating system of the organization? And we divide it across nine buckets that we look at. The first is structure and space. So how is structure and space used? Is it meeting the mission and the purpose of the organization or not? Then we look at, and this is not in order, I'm just kind of reading through, authority and decisions. How are the authority and decisions made in the organization? What are the unwritten rules and written rules for who holds power and how things happen? We look at information and communication. How is information shared, distributed? How accessible is it? How transparent is it? We look at meeting rhythms and coordination, right? Who's meeting with whom, how often, how those meetings run, how do they happen? We look at purpose and values. Are they clear? Do people know what they are? Does the organization make decisions based on them? And there are a few more buckets, so there are nine in total. And so what they really are the kind of the underpinnings of a company that often are unexamined. And so when we talk about doing org design, we don't just mean changing, you know, who sits in which office. What we mean is looking at the assumptions and the fundamental structures of your company, the way you distribute authority, the way you hold people accountable, the way you allocate resources, the way you plan your strategy. And think about, you know, where is it now and where does it have to be to achieve the results that you want to achieve. And so I think why I think this work is impactful is I think it kind of goes under the surface to start probing all those things that are implicit, all the things we never even think about, but that really, really make up culture. And so I think culture is fundamental. I think essentially what we are doing is changing culture, but I don't think you change culture by trying to change culture, right? I think you could say we're going to try to be more collaborative from today till tomorrow, but what are the inputs that feed that? So if you look at the way information is shared, you look at the way decisions are made, you look at the meeting rhythms and how meetings are run, if you change those things, you might get to more collaborative. So we're kind of going a step deeper to look at the inputs that lead to the kind of culture change that we're hoping to achieve. And it's always nice to have a nice shiny title, shiny object for people to wrap their heads around. And I think org design is that new shiny object. But in a way, it's old wine in new bottles. In a way, it's really about going deeply into the unwritten rules of the organization and trying to bring attention to them to see if they need to change.
Okay. I'll lay off org designers then. So as we come to the end of our interview, I'm really curious, with everything that you've talked about, the changing needs of the organization, the changing context, getting rid of that hidden agenda, the millennials and you know, even the iGens coming in, what does the org of the future, the workplace of the future, look like to you, and how different does it need to be to what we have predominantly today?
Gosh, that's the million-dollar question. I wish I had a simple answer. I don't even know if I have an answer, but I'm happy to riff and let's see where it takes us. Now, first of all, I think it really depends what you're doing, and I think that question of purpose is so important, right? So will a plumbing company look fundamentally different in 20 years from now than it looks today? I'm not so sure, right? Will caregiving or dog watching look fundamentally different than it looks today? You might use an app to find someone, but I'm not sure if that will look fundamentally different. And so I think it's not about finding new ways of doing work for the sake of being different or for the sake of being new. I think it's really about asking what is it that we're trying to achieve? And then what is it that we need to achieve that? But I think for many, many companies, it is going to look quite different. And I think we're starting to see those changes today. Some of the things that I'm paying attention to that I'm very curious to continue following is, first of all, just a much more loosely distributed workforce. So there are a lot of freelancers now. There are a lot of internal programs within companies where people could apply to essentially job boards and get put on projects based on their own interests, based on their own skills. So I think less people occupying a certain job or a certain role for many years because that's where they've been placed, and much more of a more flexible, whether it's internal, external job board kind of thing. I think the extreme example of this is the way an Uber driver is selected. There's no manager involved. You know, you tell the computer what you need. The computer finds someone nearby who matches that need, puts you together for a discrete amount of time. They finish the work, they get rated. That could be the case for many, many jobs, whether it's editing, video production, even certain strategy meetings. You could imagine someone saying, this is what I need, this is the input that I need. Computer matching it with someone internally in the company or externally who's able to meet that need, and then they get rated at the end, something like that. I think far more flexibility is something we're going to keep seeing more of. People working from home, people working from, you know, wherever, more video conferencing, more virtual reality work, which raises its own challenges, but I think that's where we're going. I think AI is going to continue to drive a lot of change. A lot of things that needed conscious decision-making are now being automated, some for the better, some for the worse. But I think that's going to be a major disruptor in many, many fields. If this is the kind of task that is done a certain way, and there's certain, you know, if A, then B, if B, then C, and it's pretty similar, chances are that task is going to be automated in the near future. And so what that means for all of those people and how their training might have to change in order to be able to do the kinds of things that only human beings could do. I think that's not going to change for a long time. Only human beings are capable of coming up with creative, novel ideas. Only human beings are capable of really doing deep listening and understanding client needs and product needs. You know, I think only human beings are able to collaborate across function and really understand the complexities of multiple needs and navigating that. So when I think about those kinds of skills, that's definitely going to be a need, but the more rote work is definitely going to be automated. So I don't know the details, but I think there are a few things I could say fairly confidently. Being able to think critically is going to continue to be important. Being able to be collaborative, being able to work with different kinds of people across different ways of thinking is going to continue to be really important. Being able to surface assumptions and challenge them, being able to be reflective, being able to learn, you know, these are things that I think are going to continue to be important regardless of the business that people are in. But other than that, I think we're going to have to take it one step at a time.
Well, Yehudi, thank you so much for talking to me today. I've loved it. And I wish you all the best with everything that you're doing at The Ready and in your other work. And I look forward to talking to you again.
Thank you so much. I've really enjoyed our conversation and love the way you're putting language to some of the things that we've been talking about, not just during our conversation, but in your work as well. So excited to keep following that.
Thank you very much.
I really enjoyed that conversation with Yehudi, and I hope that you enjoyed listening to it as much as I enjoyed actually being in it. One of the things that I will take away from that is this idea of the hidden curriculum, the idea that there's the stuff that we set up intentionally, and then there's the stuff that we do, all the systems that are in place that we take for granted to such an extent that we don't even notice that they're there, and we don't even notice the way that they are forming our opinions and forming our version of reality. I'm back again next week, of course, with a solo show, and I will tell you more about that during the week in my Instagram and Twitter feeds, give you a little bit of a preview. But meanwhile, here's the lovely Ivy Palmer to explain how you can stay in touch with us.
We now have a Facebook page where you can get information about the podcast, links to other articles and experts, and connect with like-minded people. Just search Punks and Suits and like our page. Of course, you can also follow Mummy on Twitter at Blair Palmer, Instagram at Blair Lees Palmer, or email her, blair@thatpeoplething.com. But most importantly, we want people to be able to find out about the podcast, and you can help with that. Please share the iTunes link on social media. Leadership is changing fast, and with your help, more people will discover how to make a difference and create organizations that are a force for good in the world.